What's your name?
Hazel.
No, what's your full name?
Hazel Grace Lancaster. Why are you looking at me like that?
Because you're beautiful.
Oh my god.
Let's go watch a movie.
What?
Hmm?
Huh? I'm free later this week.
No, I mean now.
You could be an axe murderer.
There's always that possibility.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today is senior editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Today we will be talking about this weekend's releases, Edge of Tomorrow and The Fault in Our Stars. At the box office, it was, well, not a surprising turn of events, because The Fault in Our Stars had been tracking very well. It still was a change of pace, in some senses a bit of counter-programming. Would you say that, Adam, in terms of a blockbuster season and a romantic film coming in to dominate?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, studios always try to do a bit of counter-programming in the summer in the middle of the Transformers and the Independence Days and all of those, and they normally do okay. They don't really break out. It's basically Hollywood's way of saying, like, we know your husband or boyfriend wants to go see Transformers, and we know you'll go see that. So here's something for you and your girlfriends.
So pandering.
Yeah, well, because the primary difference between men and women, I think, in like movie going and literature, is that men have a hard time relating to a female lead character, so they don't really want to go and see that, whereas women don't have trouble relating to a lead character, be it male or female. They're fine going and, like, they are not put off by the fact that the lead is a male or a female, whereas I think a lot of men are just like, oh, I can't relate to that, it's a girl, which is stupid.
That is stupid. That is incredibly
stupid.
And
so that's why we get, you know, the Nicholas Sparks and all those things in the middle, because Hollywood's like, here you go with your lady friends, because your husband's not going to go.
Yeah. That being said, a $50 million box office is very good. It's a lot of people saying it's stunning. However, it's not like Godzilla, where if you think that's like, you have half the amount of people going, where at most a guy's like, all right, I'll go see Cancer Love.
Yeah, basically. Well, and I mean, my girlfriend was a huge fan of the book, and like 6 or 8 months ago, she was like, Fault in Our Stars is going to be huge. And I was like, we'll see. Like, in my mind, the best it was going to do was kind of like Perks of Being a Wallflower Business, where it was like, it got pretty good reviews, and, you know, it made, you know, 50, like maybe 20 million in the weekend, because, I mean, it's opening office to Tom Cruise. It's clearly not going to beat that. And I thought it would be this little movie, but I think that it, first of all, it got really positive reviews. It was a good movie, so that helps the movie being good. And then second of all, I think they lucked out with a kind of hook, kind of marketing campaign. It became the movie that will destroy you, the movie that will make you cry. And so everyone kept hearing about this movie that makes everyone cry. So it was in the zeitgeist. It was word of mouth. People were talking about it, and they kept talking about it. And the reviews were good. They were like, oh, I've heard of that movie, because that's the movie everyone says makes you cry. So I think, as opposed to something that people were kind of unsure what it was or whatever, I think it was very much in the conversation, kind of in the air. And then the positive reviews helped that. And, you know, obviously it has a big audience of book fans that came out. But, yeah, I mean, with a budget of $12 million, this is a fantastic success story.
In some ways, it kind of reminds me of, like, I don't know. It's a film that's trying very hard at some points to not be sappy. It opens up with laughs, with Mike Birbiglia coming in, yeah, and saying it's okay to laugh at this movie, there are jokes here, but at the same time it definitely pushes for tears in some ways. Like, I mean, it's not that it's unearned, but it pushes for tears in the same way that any movie is really pushing for an emotion. Like, Godzilla rampaging is going to get cheers, and you know, Seth Rogen swinging around a dildo is going to get laughs, things like that.
Yeah. So I didn't really feel that it was pushing for tears as much as my biggest criticism of it would be that at times it felt a little too twee, a little too, like, they're so adorable. But then
I agree with that.
But then I would go back to, well, they're teenagers. Like, this is a story about teenagers. And when teenagers are in love, that is the world. That is everything to them.
Well, it's not necessarily like, oh, it's the world to that. That's fine. Like, in The Spectacular Now, that totally worked.
Sure.
This is more like teenagers, particularly Gus, no one is that sharp. And certainly, I mean, yes, I admire the confidence. I appreciate it. But there is something there that feels a bit contrived. And in the book, it feels balanced by Hazel's inner monologue,
yeah,
which is very somewhat cynical, somewhat jaded, and sort of playing against this effervescent guy who always knows the right thing to say and how to say it, and it's just, there's pretty much perfect, except for the one moment near the end of the book. Do you want to talk about spoilers? Should we talk about spoilers? Because I kind of want to go into specifics here.
Yeah, we can go into specifics. Right. We'll put it in this article. If you want to skip to Edge of Tomorrow, we'll tell you where you can skip to that if you haven't seen Fault in Our Stars yet. But right. If you have, keep listening.
Keep listening. In the book, when Gus goes to get cigarettes as he's dying, that was devastating. Like,
yeah.
He's throwing up on himself. Like, she is seeing him at his worst in a way that she's never seen him before. The movie had that, but I don't think it went for it with the same amount of punch.
Definitely. That was one of the things that I noticed as well, is that you never really see Gus sick, because in the book, Gus gets really sick. And, you know, he puts on this face of, you know, he's staring in the face of oblivion. He's really charming. He's really smooth. But in the book, it was very important to see he's still a kid. Like, this kid is 19 years old and he's dying of cancer, and it's awful. He's scared. It's terrible. He's sick. He can't do anything. And that was important to see that side of him in the book. And there wasn't as much of that in the movie.
Yeah, I definitely. And that's something that I felt. I wonder if they removed it because they're like, this is just too much. We've already hit. Because to me, the scene, and I don't know if this was the same way in your theater, but for me at my screening, I could, the sniffling and the choking back tears was audible in the eulogy scene where,
yeah,
she's talking about the infinities.
Yeah, and that's something, having read the book, I was a little prepared for. The thing in the book that destroyed me was when she opens up his letter at the end and it turns out he wrote her a eulogy. And that was the moment that I was like, oh, God. But yeah, the eulogy scene in this movie, he wants to attend his own funeral. And that's the thing that they retain from John Green's book that I liked, because John Green's tone is so, and I was talking about this, is you can't describe the book or the movie without it sounding like a really contrived, cliched thing. But John Green is so good at bringing in this cynicism from Hazel, and not necessarily cynicism, but just a realistic view. She knows she's going to die, and she's not afraid of that. And I really liked in the movie how they kept those touches of that. They felt like real kids. Like, they talk about the existence of God. They talk, like, they have sex. They're not afraid to curse. They are aware of their situation. When Hazel says, oh, you're wearing your death suit, it's not, she's not, like, destroyed by thinking of the fact that he might die. It's familiar to her because she picked out a dress that she will die in.
Right, there's a culture there.
Exactly, and I thought that was handled perfectly in the movie. The kind of tone, John Green's tone of not necessarily cynicism, but an understanding of their place in reality. This wasn't
right.
Like, oh my God, we're dying of cancer, and it's so, I get so sad talking about it. They've lived with this for 10, 15 years. They've been through the test. They've been through everything. So
right.
They're a little bit jaded.
Right. It's not like, I don't know, Love Story or that fucking Mandy Moore film from the late 90s, early
2000s.
A Walk to Remember, where, like, we're in love and then the sickness happens. I mean, it kind of, like, he does get sick.
Yeah.
But the sickness was always in the mix.
Yeah. They're always living on, they're always aware of the fact that they have a limited number of days left. They just
right.
don't know when it's over.
Yeah, it's, yeah, and that's one of the things I like about it. Again, like, it's a film that's biting enough to temper its moments that I think would be very saccharine without it.
Yeah, definitely. And then there's enough humor there and stuff like that. And that's the part I liked about the movie. I did. I really liked the movie. I really liked the book. I wouldn't say I loved the movie. I wouldn't say it was, you know, amazing or perfect or anything. It was a little bit long. And like I said, it just their romance comes off as a little twee at times for a film that's so grounded in reality and the fact that she feels like these feel like real people. Sometimes their romance came off a little bit like that. And then, of course, the applauding in the Anne Frank house was just strange.
Yeah, no one seems to. I understand the thinking behind that
scene.
I do. I understand it, but execution-wise, it just doesn't. There's just some things that I get what you're going for. In fact, you could have actually even pulled it off if they had just made out after the Anne Frank house. But the fact that they're like in the room with like photos of dead children, you know, and
well,
I
would have even been fine if they had just like kissed and made out. Or like a little bit,
like a little kiss.
Yeah,
yeah, but like
it was the applauding for me that I was like, oh, that's a little odd. And then you can say it's in the book. Like, fine, that's in the book. You can read that.
It
in a
doesn't
book.
Mean it works in the book either.
Exactly.
Like, that's not a,
and it doesn't
that
mean
is not
just
a defense.
Because something's in the book doesn't mean it should be in the movie.
So, right.
And that's one of the areas where I was a little. I thought Josh Boone's direction was fine. I thought he handled things really well. I mean, he's been very vocal about he had a best friend who died of cancer. This book meant a lot to him. And I thought it was good, but it was moments like that where I was kind of interested to see what maybe a more experienced or more a director who had more of a voice would have done. But I mean, it's not really a complaint against Josh Boone. I'm not saying he did a bad job.
It's such
I thought
a
he did.
Weird choice for The Stand after seeing this movie.
He is.
Like,
yeah.
I wonder if Warner Brothers was like, well, he's made a movie where people die from disease, so I guess he's good. I guess he's good for what he envisions as a 3-hour R-rated film with A-list actors.
Yeah.
That would probably cost a lot of money.
I don't know. Maybe it's I assume it has something to do with adaptations and the fact that
that might be it.
He was he's a very, very, very big Stephen King fan and The Stand fan, and maybe they saw how he handled this, which I thought was a really well done adaptation. I thought the script by Newt Stoddard and Weber was really, it captured the essence of the book right. For the most part, it knew what to drop and what to keep.
Yeah, like in the book, like his video game, which is very weird.
Yeah.
Like the kind of I never even fully understood the game that he was playing. Like, it felt like something with Oculus Rift, like the amount of detail in it.
Yeah, you get enough of it in the movie to understand that, like, oh, they're sharing their interest, even though this is a book that Hazel would never in a million years read. She's reading it because she adores Gus and she cares about Gus, and then vice versa, the same with her book.
I thought it was a solid adaptation. I am fine that it didn't well that it did well. Now we should see all the imitators just
Well, and that's what someone was asking me, if you recommended someone what to see this week in Fault in Our Stars or Edge of Tomorrow, even though I think I liked Edge of Tomorrow a little bit more. I would almost say Fault in Our Stars, because there's something, it's a movie that its box office has potentially positive ramifications that could serve as a bellwether to get more films like this off the ground, because this movie was shopped to a bunch of different studios and they just said, we can't make this, like, this isn't a movie, we're not going to do it. And the only way Fox 2000 would do it is if they made it for nothing, and they made it for $12 million. That's why Josh Boone directed it. They got a director that wasn't too expensive and everything. But I think the result was, you know, great. I was a little, not iffy, but I was a little underwhelmed by the casting of Laura Dern and Sam Trammell as Hazel's parents. But those were the parts of the movie that really, really got me. Because at the end of the day, this is a story about kids with cancer. But I thought the movie did a really good job of capturing what it also means for these parents who, like, their children are dying. And that was a part of the book that I really appreciated. The fact that, you know, Hazel is okay with dying, but she's doing all this stuff for her parents.
She's very concerned with, like, the people that would be left behind.
Exactly, yes. And I thought that was a little, they touched on it a bit at the beginning of the movie, but they kind of dropped that a little towards the end, and I would have liked to have seen that kind of continue, because having read the book, I understood that she's doing all these things for her parents, and her parents really care about her and everything. But in the movie, it's at the beginning, you kind of understand it, but it's dropped a little in the background.
Yeah, I agree. I would say between the two, I would actually give my vote towards Edge of Tomorrow, because I feel that, well, on the one hand, yes, I'm glad that Hollywood will pick up on this film. I feel like the imitators will be so poor. I feel like they're going to really miss what makes this movie work. And so it's actually going to, I don't want to say do more harm than good, and I'm not against necessarily making these kind of movies. Whereas I feel with Edge of Tomorrow, even though, yes, it is based off a Japanese novel, no one fucking read that. Like, it's about as close as we can get now to an original film this year, now that Jupiter Ascending was kicked to February 2015. And it's smart sci-fi. It's got good humor. It's got good action. And I think when you, I think in terms of all the action movies we're getting, to get something that was this original is more encouraging. And I think because Hollywood is going to keep making the big action films anyway, because like you said, they feel they can get a male and a female audience into them, I would wish that Edge of Tomorrow would spawn more imitators than the imitators I fear will be spawned by The Fault in Our Stars.
Well, I guess my thinking is less of imitators and more of female-led studio films, because studios are just wary of doing female. And like when you start to line these up, Hollywood is great at ignoring things until something really, really catches on. And so, you know, you can say we've had really good successes with like The Hunger Games and Divergent, and you know, Catching Fire was really great, Frozen. I feel like it has to hit kind of an overwhelming point in order for Hollywood to finally listen, because still, even like when did Hunger Games come out? 2010? 2011? 2012, maybe. I don't know.
2012.
Remember. Yeah.
2012, because they wanted to get Catching Fire out ASAP.
Yeah, and we're 2 years later, and it's still not that. The market hasn't changed that much, and I am really a big fan of. I just really would like to see more female-driven.
Well, I think part of it is like, you know, the market hasn't changed that much, but also the market has to serve a worldwide audience, which is always important to keep in mind, and B, really what they're trying to find is stuff that can be really drawn out with tons of material. So Hunger Games is great, but it's three books that are just being stretched to four. Same with Divergent. Now, take a comic book by contrast, and it's like there's a whole universe and room for spinoffs and fucking toys and drinks. And it's not that you can't get that with Hunger Games, but in terms of like what's already built in to feed the machine, I think they see something as Hunger Games as more limited than something where, you know, bullshit superhero, or they will spawn, again, imitators. Like if you get Twilight, A, there's a ceiling there, as we saw.
Mm-hmm.
B, granted, those films are bad, but B, the imitators it spawns is like, you know, you get Mortal Instruments, and it's like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Or, oh gosh, I don't even know anymore. Yeah. Well, I don't even remember the imitators.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I found Fault in Our Stars surprising, because I, you know, people were like, oh, it has a giant book fan base. And I'm like, well, so did Mortal Instruments. So did, again, I can't remember because these are so, but in the wake of Twilight, there were so many YA adaptations and so many of them just.
Right. And the YA adaptations aren't going to stop.
No, If I Stay coming up with Chloe Moretz. I feel like that's the kind of Fault in Our Stars imitator, even though it went into production probably around the same time. But I feel like that's the kind of imitator that we might see, is more of less of the, well, not less, but in addition to the sci-fi fantasy YA novels, now you can get into stuff like Fault in Our Stars, where it's like romantic dramas or more dramatic material.
Yeah, there doesn't need to be a supernatural aspect.
No. Which
and
would
that'd
be nice.
Be fun. Yeah, no, it would be nice. I agree. No, it would just be nice to have more diversity in the marketplace, period.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, I will say this, though. This summer has been pretty damn good so far. It really has. But I'm looking ahead to the months ahead, and I'm starting to see a dry spell where I'm like, am I really interested in what's coming down the pipeline? And, like, I am excited for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But, like, I'm looking at July, and I'm like, am I really excited for anything in July? Shit, I'm not. Even next week, I don't really care that much about Jersey Boys.
Next
because
week's Jump Street and How to Train.
Oh, I'm sorry. The week. Yes, I am excited as shit for Jump Street.
Yeah, and How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Yes. But after that, then it starts cooling, and then, of course, you have Transformers, which I don't care about. I'm amazed at how little I care about Transformers. I mean, I thought I didn't care about it at all, but it turns out I can care so much less.
Oh, me too. Because I was like, my initial reaction was like, you know, fool me twice, like never again. I think the first one's all right, but I was like, never again. And then I was like, well, they'll probably have trailers that pump up like really cool action. I'll be like, oh, I want to see that. But no. Especially now knowing it's 147 fucking minutes long.
Oh, fuck me. Fuck me. Why? Jesus.
Because Michael Bay chooses to, and he does what he wants.
Because Michael Bay has to, like, I need everything to be bigger.
Yeah.
Does it have to be better? Fuck no, just bigger. Just what kind of goddamn plot can you even fill?
No idea.
What the hell?
But you're right, there is not much coming down the pipeline. I guess not really along the lines of Fault, but another female-driven movie is Tammy with Melissa McCarthy, but I'm still...
That looks awful.
See, I think it looks all right, but it could go either way.
Yeah, to me, that's almost like Melissa McCarthy playing into the criticism people have of her now.
Which is interesting because it was, like, she wrote this years ago, and it was poised to be her directorial debut, and her husband, Ben Falcone, ended up directing it. I'm sure she, like, if DJA wasn't crazy...
She probably has a co-directing credit.
Yeah. But yeah, it is interesting because I heard a lot of criticism. I've been hearing a lot of criticisms of, like, she's essentially playing a clown, but this is very much a movie she chose to do and wanted to do. So.
Right. And that's fine. I'm glad that she wants to do it. I'm just saying, from what I've seen from the trailers, I am not excited.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. But before we start already going down the summer spiral, I want to talk more about Edge of Tomorrow, which I really enjoyed.
Definitely.
And I think kind of came out of nowhere in a way. I thought the trailers were pretty good, too. It wasn't like it looked abysmal, but I think everyone was a little surprised at how much they liked it.
Yeah, I was really excited for it because I thought the trailers looked great, and I'm an avid Tom Cruise fan. I really, really like Tom Cruise. I even like him in Oblivion, which is a really boring movie. But
yep.
So I was excited for it, but again, like you said, I was not predicting the kind of universal acclaim that it had. And if only the box office had backed that up. Because it seems like his thing recently is, you know, he's in movies that don't make a ton of money or aren't that well reviewed.
Yeah, really his star power is as an international star now.
Yeah,
because exactly. He will just rake in. His movies will be successful overseas. And it is kind of a shame, though, because not that I'm like, I need an Edge of Tomorrow sequel, but I am kind of jazzed. Like, all right, we're going to get another Jack Reacher movie, maybe. Like, all
yeah.
right.
And that was
I
another
really
fantastic
like...
movie that did not do great. I mean, it did all right at the box office. It's one of those that's literally on the cusp of just making just enough money to warrant a sequel.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not really against it. And Edge of Tomorrow was really fun, and it hit a lot of beats that I think... You know, I would give a film like Godzilla like more action spectacle, and yeah, it's steeped in history, but I cared more about the characters in Edge of Tomorrow.
Absolutely.
I laughed more in Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
It has some of my favorite jokes this year. Bill Paxton fucking stealing the show when he showed up. And it makes me even angrier that when we were at Comic-Con last year, it seemed like they forgot to invite him. He was at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
Or his daughter was doing something, and they had an Edge of Tomorrow panel, and no one thought, like, hey, maybe we should have him on this panel, and Chris Hardwick, of all people, has to, like, call him up to the stage.
I think it was Tom Cruise who called him up.
Oh, it was Tom Cruise?
Yeah. Tom was like,
the fact
Bill,
that,
get up here.
Yeah, the fact that anyone, the fact that Warner Brothers didn't think, like, hey, let's put a seat out here for Bill, like, someone should have thought of that. And as we saw from the X-Men panel, there was fucking room. There's a lot of room on that stage.
There's room for people who don't even end up in the finished cut. Anna Paquin made the trip to Comic-Con. She's in the movie for like 3 seconds.
Yes, she is.
Got a magazine cover
and everything.
Yeah. The thing about Edge of Tomorrow that really surprised me is that I was really looking forward to it and I was really excited about it. And then once I started watching it, I was like, oh, this is thrilling and smart. And then the minute you start to feel like, oh, we're going to do it again or it's going to go back and it's going to be, you know, something I've seen again, I'm going to get bored. Lyman switches it just like that. And you're like, oh, whoa, I'm surprised. Because I loved how they played with the conventions of it, because you go in thinking like, oh, I'm going to live these days over and over again. But sometimes it skips forward. Sometimes we're in an area of the day and we don't even know that Tom Cruise has already done this multiple times before, which was a
great
surprise.
Right, it keeps you guessing.
Yeah, it keeps you
wondering. And it really takes advantage of the script, of the plot device, because the script can basically do whatever it wants. It's like, how does he know these things? Because he's done it. We just didn't see it. Every pretty much closes every plot hole.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I can get anyone to do whatever I want because I know them. I can just... He basically has almost a godlike power, and one of the things I admire about the film is that it managed to still keep him grounded. Like, to humanize him and almost find more comedy in his power rather than just letting him coast through.
Yeah, definitely. And again, going back to the female leads, Emily Blunt is fantastic in this. I was so looking forward to this after seeing her in Looper, kind of seeing what she could do. And everyone's like, oh, she's kick-ass, she's badass. But like this, again, it shows that a female lead isn't quote-unquote kick-ass or badass. What makes her great and intriguing and interesting is that she's an interesting character. She doesn't just, you know, act like a man. That doesn't make her better.
That's such a tired thing. Like, a tough chick is basically a chick who acts like a man.
Everyone's like, oh, she kicks ass, she needs her own movie. Well, you know, she is a really good female character. And she's a good character. I shouldn't even say female character. She's a great character. She's an interesting character. That's what I want to see more of. And it makes me excited to see, I mean, she is leading her own movie with Denis Villeneuve, who directed Prisoners. She's leading his next movie, Sicario.
It sort of does, watching her, you're always going to have to keep in the back of your mind, what if, because she was going to be Black Widow until Fox forced her to be in Gulliver's Travels.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, no, she was like the top choice, and then Fox exercised their option on her and made her be in Gulliver's Travel, and that's what cleared the way for Scarlett Johansson.
Seems like it's not all right for Blunt.
Oh, yeah, no, it's not like it tanked her career, but... And I think Johansson's a good Black Widow. I think it worked out for everyone, but it's just watching her in something like this, it's like, I wonder what her Black Widow would have been like.
Sure, just... I wonder, but if the trade-off is that we don't get her in Looper, then I'm totally fine with this. And seeing how the Marvel Universe is going now, I mean, from my perspective...
Now it's on its downslide.
For me, it's never really been high art.
I know, yeah, I know. It's never been... But now you see it imploding.
Yeah. It makes me happy that she's not under like a 9-picture contract at Marvel or whatever.
That is true, but
she has the freedom to do something like Sicario, which is very promising.
Exactly. I mean, and also, let's be fair, Scarlett Johansson isn't, her hands haven't been completely tied. She can do Under the Skin.
Yeah, which definitely.
So again, but we get, oh man, even in a weekend that has nothing to do with Marvel.
We get back to Marvel.
We get Marvel. I was just, it was just a fun side note in terms of like a tough female character who you could see again and again. Edge of Tomorrow probably will not be getting a sequel, and I'm perfectly okay with that. Even if it had been a success, like at the box office, I still didn't want to see a sequel.
No.
But
what's amazing is they barely pulled this one off. I don't know if you read the profile of Doug Liman where.
Oh, yeah.
They started without an ending, and they had, like, 8 different screenwriters on it.
It's a Doug Liman film, where it's basically a train wreck, and you hope for the best.
Yeah.
And he yelled, at one point, Emily Blunt's like, I don't know what I'm doing, and he's like, neither do I! It's like, you're the fucking director!
That was, like, 6 weeks before production began. She was like, you have to slow down, I've never done this before. He was like, neither have I. I was like, oh,
right.
No.
But this is his best...
He spins it into gold.
Well, I think this is easily his best... blockbuster film. I think that my problem, as I said in my review, Born Identity, which I've seen, I rewatched it before Born Legacy came out, is just kind of a flat film. It doesn't really know who, it's very wrapped up in the mystery, and it's got some okay action scenes. Like, I mean, I really like the fight between Matt Damon and Clive Owen, but you really don't have a sense of Born, you never really get much of a sense of Born as a character until Born Supremacy and Ultimatum. That's when the series starts coming together. Mr. and Mrs. Smith is really fun. Doesn't have an ending.
No.
There's a big fight, and then the movie ends. Like, there's no... It's just like, we ran out of movie. Okay. And then Jumper sucks. It just flat out sucks.
I never saw Jumper.
It sucks. It's not good. Oh, well, Adam, let me tell you. There was this guy, there was this actor named Hayden Christensen. For a while... People thought you could put a film on him, and they were wrong. Although
Christian
I do like
just trust in him. So
yeah. Well, I will say this: I do like Shattered Glass, but I think Christensen's fine. But that film is probably best for boosting Peter Sarsgaard's career.
Yeah.
But in any event, Jumper you can skip, dear listeners.
Sure.
But this was great. It came together from start to finish.
It really did, and I mean, it is by far my favorite blockbuster of this year, And it's really, the thing is, it's really smart. It doesn't make its audience feel stupid, and it's also not afraid to do different things. Like, I can envision a lot of other actors being offered this role, and they're like, well, I don't want to play a coward. Like, I don't want to be that guy. But Tom Cruise is so fucking good, and it's so different from what we've seen him do before, because you think of Tom Cruise, like, the action hero who can do everything. And in this movie, he's playing a completely different type of character than we've seen before. And he gives it so much pathos and so much... There's just so much to hang on to. And that's why it makes me sad that, you know, I know you've read in the LA Times, Amy Nicholson wrote up this fantastic kind of profile on Tom Cruise's career and how he's the last living movie star, and talked about how, you know, all the hubbub about his personal life kind of forced him to step away from the more interesting roles that he was doing and just go straight doing just straight action roles. And it makes me, you know, kind of long for something else, something more along the lines of Magnolia or even a Jerry Maguire in the future. And it's kind of sad to think that, you know, the way these, you know, quote unquote guaranteed wins, like Edge of Tomorrow, you know, you got Tom Cruise in the starring role, it's a big blockbuster, a lot of money, guy who made Bourne Identity, can't lose. And movies like this not doing extremely well. It's just disappointing. It makes you think that he might just, you know, kind of keep at it.
Or another possibility is maybe he steps away for a film or two and does like another ensemble like Magnolia, where
sure.
he gets to. And also, I mean, there are actors at his level, like A-list actors, who have no problem being ensemble. I think that's one of the reasons we think of Tom Cruise as a movie star. Is yeah, he stars alongside good actors, but he's not really an ensemble guy. Like he has like one or two co-stars. Whereas if I look at, I mean, I have trouble seeing Tom Cruise doing something like Burn After Reading, where you have Brad Pitt and George Clooney, like big movie stars in a weird movie where they're just two pieces of a much stranger beast.
Yeah, I think it's just he's at this point in his career where it would be really tough for the audience to buy into something like that. Like, I couldn't really see Tom Cruise as like an Ocean's 11 ensemble or something like that.
That is whereas, true, because yeah, he has sort of set this trajectory.
Yeah, Brad Pitt and George Clooney make a habit of kind of doing these ensembles, and even like Matt Damon in like Monuments Men, stuff like that. You've seen them before, so you're comfortable seeing them in an ensemble. I think it would be uncomfortable to see Tom Cruise in one because he's...
I mean, it might be uncomfortable, but it might be a necessary pivot.
Oh, sure, definitely. But and this is what's so interesting about it, and what makes it unique is that in a lot of other, you know, actors' careers, I would be like, oh gosh, like they keep making the same action movie over and over again, and I want to see him go back. Tom Cruise has been doing fantastic, you know, movies over the past few years. If you leave out Oblivion and Rock of Ages, I mean, you look at Jack Reacher is great, Ghost Protocol is fantastic. I really like Night and Day. I think Valkyrie's all right. I mean, I guess Valkyrie was around the time where he was having some trouble, but he's making good blockbusters.
And he's been
part.
Good in them. Like War of the Worlds, I mean, that's when sort of his troubles began.
Yeah.
That, he's a really good performance. I read and I'm not going to look to internet comment sections as a fountain of wisdom, but someone's like, he plays the same role in every, you know, he's the same performance in every film. And that's not really true.
No, look at Collateral. Jeez.
Collateral. And I think someone, I forget where, but they're like, every Tom Cruise performance is about caring about the work. First off, it's not the performance. They're saying the character cares about the work.
Yeah.
I can kind of see that, like all of his characters. But even then, it's. I mean, his character in War of the Worlds is kind of a slacker.
Yeah.
He's irresponsible. That film is about his character learning to be responsible. So, I don't know. Like, Rock of Ages, that's kind of a... I mean, although
that
is
the best part of it by far.
I mean, it is, but that, hey, there's an ensemble piece.
Yeah,
and that's that. But that film has problems beyond him.
That's the way it works, is because Stacey Jacks is this larger than life rock star.
And the same goes for Tropic Thunder.
Yeah,
he's not really on the same level. But there again, I mean, I guess, you know, his character in Tropic Thunder really cares about the work, but not in... I don't know. Sometimes when you lay that broad definition on it, like every character wants something.
Yeah, that's screenwriting. That's making...
It really is. Like, this character has a job and he wants to do it. Yeah. Like, yes. Yes, he does.
And there are obstacles in the way of achieving that goal.
I mean, like, to say, like, his... Yeah, I mean, Minority Report, yes, his character starts caring about the work. But
kinda,
yeah.
Yeah.
Kinda, yeah. It's a bit of a broad definition. And I understand what they were going for, because Tom Cruise, as an actor, cares about the work. And I think that's one of the things that's so admirable about him. I think he would get far more admiration if it weren't for the Scientology thing. I really
Absolutely.
Do.
Yeah.
I think that is really the... And I have to believe, I don't have to, but a part of me believes that one day he'll quit it. Like,
yeah.
Late into his career, when it's all sort of quieted down, he's like, this is bullshit. And I'm the only person keeping this organization afloat. But, yeah, I don't know. Maybe that day will never come, but I'd like to think it will.
Well,
I will say...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that... in terms of caring so much about the work, as a guy I know pointed out on Twitter, Tom Cruise hung off the tallest building in the world for our entertainment.
Yes, yeah. Well, and part of the frustrating thing about the whole quote-unquote explosion, the Scientology thing, is that if you watch him in interviews now, and no one works harder to promote their film more than Tom Cruise. He was flying all over the country to theaters last week to surprise audiences at screenings and stuff, and you see him on talk shows and stuff, but I was watching him on The Daily Show and also on The Tonight Show, and seeing him around, you can see that he's very conscious of how he's coming off, and it feels a bit restrained, and it's kind of sad that he isn't able to really be comfortable on those shows or open up, because he's always aware of, you know, he's one, you know, stand up away. If he stands up from the chair, people are like, oh no, what's he doing? What's Tom Cruise doing now? He's being crazy. He's going to jump on the couch again. He's very mindful of the fact that, you know, people thought he was just this crazy person who was jumping around on TV. And so it is kind of sad seeing him in those talk shows not really being able to be super comfortable. He doesn't come off as uncomfortable. He comes off fine. But
there are other actors who just seem like they're at ease with it because they know no one, they don't have that magnifying glass.
Exactly, and they don't have the baggage.
Right. And that's the thing. What's interesting is I remember I was interviewing Ben Affleck for I think it was Gone Baby Gone, and he comes in the room and he's very affable, but like this was like that this was his directorial debut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great film. I still think it's his best film that he's directed. But it's his directorial debut, and you have to remember he had been tabloid fodder for years.
Yeah.
Like, you know, between him and Jennifer Lopez and that whole thing, they just, and then Geely was such a bomb, and people just like sort of chewed him up, and really him directing was the sort of resurgence in his career. But so we're sitting at this round table interview and people are asking him questions, and he was very patient and choose, and you could see that he was carefully selecting his words. Now, he was still having fun. I remember, you know, he gets a phone call from Jennifer Garner in the middle of the interview. He's like, I'm having my little Rudy Giuliani moment, because at the time, Rudy Giuliani had been doing a press conference and his wife called him in the middle of that. So, I mean, he was still fun and having fun with us, but you can tell that they're very, sometimes very aware of their public perception. And I mean, they all are. That's why they have publicists.
Yeah.
And
unless you're Shailene Woodley, where now
you
just,
who's just
don't
like,
give a fuck.
No publicist, let me give you a hug.
Yeah. No one, my ages don't know I'm here. I'm going to walk around barefoot in New York City after this. Just doesn't care, which is a refreshing change of pace.
It is incredibly refreshing. It almost makes you wish Divergent doesn't take off.
Yeah,
although
it already
I don't.
Did. I mean, it's done. That sign, seal, delivered.
No. But I mean, in terms of like, it's such a dickish thing. It's like, I hope she doesn't get more popular. I want more people to like her, but I don't want her to get mobbed. Whereas I think, like Jennifer Lawrence has reached that mob point.
Yeah.
Or I think, to put it another way, I think the Hunger Games movies are going to keep getting bigger, whereas I don't think the Divergent movies are going to keep getting bigger.
No, I think it'll pretty much level out. And going back to Fault in Our Stars, the movie almost surpassed the opening weekend of Divergent, which cost like a million times more to make than Fault in Our Stars.
And to market.
Yes, and to market.
Yeah, so...
Very much.
That's the thing. Although, but again, I think the benefit of a movie like The Fault in Our Stars for her career is that it, again, opens more doors. And I said this in my review, one of the things that impressed me about her performance is that it wasn't just a retread of her character in Spectacular Now, which it easily could have been.
Yeah.
Because she's
yeah.
very
or
good
even,
at playing real teenagers.
Or even Shades of the Descendants.
Or Shades of the Descendants. Yeah, that sort of cynical teenager. Yeah,
yeah.
No, she is... And this is really someone, you know, to pull the Tom Cruise comparison, you could say, oh, she's just giving the same performance. No. Oh, her character's all the same. Not really. You know, like, she's playing to her age in a different, you know, as she is, but like to say that they're the same kind of movies or the same kind of characters is very, it's glib. It's
yes,
so glib.
It's glib. Gosh, don't bring that.
I know. I couldn't help myself.
Ruining,
I'm sorry.
Ruining my whole
I no. Well, look, again, I'm not going to, that's nuts.
Yes.
Telling someone they shouldn't be on postpartum medication is wrong. I'm sorry, that's wrong. The jumping on the couch thing, I get that. That's I mean, Nicholson's article breaks that down beautifully as we created a cultural memory that never happened.
Yeah.
But there's I've seen the you're being glib and writing off a someone else's life and their life choices, which is whatever. But again, that doesn't reflect on the work as an actor. He is at the top of his game and has been for quite some time.
Yeah, and the fact that Christopher McQuarrie, I think, pitched in quite a bit on the screenplay for Edge of Tomorrow, and that his next movie is Mission Impossible 5 with McQuarrie directing and, I assume, having a heavy hand on the screenplay. He's been over there in London working on it for a while.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what Drew Pearce is also sort of putting into it as well.
Yeah,
like,
well,
how
he
much
said
McQuarrie...
that Drew Pearce said that he wrote... You know, he wrote a draft, he did his work, and then he sent it off, and he said, but, you know, Chris is a writer, too, so I've done my part, and it's in good hands, but, you know,
exactly.
That's kind of how the life of a writer goes. You're hired to do a rewrite.
Sure.
You do the rewrite, you send it off, and it's not really your
yep.
baby. So.
But it turns out that Jeremy Renner is the Mandarin.
Yes, yes. I would be fine with Jeremy Renner not returning. He was fine in Ghost Protocol, but...
Really? I would like him. One of the things I really liked about Ghost Protocol and what I was hoping it would set for the future of the franchise, because at the time... before it came out, they're like, it's kind of a reboot and it's kind of him handing off the reins. But what it turned out to be more was that it was a reboot in the sense of we're refashioning Mission Impossible as a team movie again. Or not again, but like the first three were really all about Ethan Hunt. And Ghost Protocol is a team film. And I really like that. And I know that Simon Pegg's coming back. Jeremy Renner says he's coming back. And I hope Paula Patton's coming back because I like that dynamic. I like their dynamic together and I like that it gives the franchise new life. So
sure, definitely. I'm not a huge fan of Jeremy Renner, action star. I think he's much better as a character actor.
I mean, he does want his chems.
Yes, give me the chems.
chems. Oh, that's what we're gonna need in the next Bourne film is more chems.
More chems, yes. Who's doing that? Justin Lin, right?
Yeah. Yes, Justin Lin.
Take it or leave it. It's fine.
Yeah, really, at this point, like, the worst thing to come out of the Bourne franchise is just people asking Matt Damon, everybody's going to do another Bourne movie? Well, if Paul comes back, and it's never going to happen.
Universal's like, fuck you, Paul, we hate you, so it's...
Fuck you, Paul, sorry.
I think they hate each other. I think there's a lot of vitriol between Greengrass and Universal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, that's just the way he makes his movies, is I'm going to shoot a bunch of shit and I'll find it in the editing room.
Yeah.
And boy, do studios love that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, the sad thing about Edge of Tomorrow. You know that if Edge of Tomorrow would have worked out, Warner Brothers would have been like, you're a genius, Doug Liman. And now that it's not doing terribly. It's doing fine, but not on par for what it should be.
Well, I think at least for Liman is like, yes, the box office is underperforming, but I think the critical appraisal will help him out.
Yeah.
Whereas
he's already on Splinter Cell. He's already lined up his next thing. So
right, exactly. And I think like the difference is like, yeah, the Bourne films were really successful, but in the whole what have you done for me lately thing,
yeah,
Green Zone was met with lukewarm reviews and bad box office.
Yeah.
And then to say, you know, let me do whatever I want, and they're like, well, we already were sort of not comfortable with you doing whatever the hell you wanted. And we let it happen as long as it was working, and it didn't work, and now we want to clamp down. And he's like, fuck y'all, I don't need no Bourne films. Look at me. I'm the captain now. Oh, yeah, so there it is. And but it was, I think, overall, look, films, whether succeed or underperform, I feel, and I... this was a weekend where we got two good movies.
Yeah.
And that's a great and that is a great thing. I think summer is going really well so far. We'll see how it continues, but really, I mean, we've really washed that bad Spider-Man taste out of our mouths.
Until so. Jersey Boys, the most boring musical of all time, because it's directed by Clint Eastwood.
And the thing is, you liked the musical, though.
I did. It's fun. I would have loved to have seen Jon Favreau's version.
But yeah, someone who like seems to have fun and vivacity with.
I watched the recent featurette they released for Jersey Boys and the interviews with Clint Eastwood. Basically, it sounds like Warner Brothers was like, "Hey, Clint, we have Jersey Boys," and he was like, "Oh, I like music, sure." Like he doesn't. Really
I like music, and I and A Star Is Born is stalled out.
Yeah,
so.
There's just no passion for the material there. He's just.
It really
like,
is.
Sure. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, he's basically working to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And he doesn't really care.
I'm sure
about,
he likes the music and he enjoys the.
I do enjoy music.
Sure.
I don't think I should get a shot at directing Jersey Boys.
No.
I mean, I too could direct it, and in the sense of we're gonna do one, two takes max.
Yeah, half a take.
Half a take.
Yeah.
How do you even do that with a musical? Musicals require so much more, like especially one with. Like, the performers are on stage. I mean, I guess he's covering the stage with, like, three or four cameras.
Sure.
And they'll just cut it together. But God forbid we do more than one take. Yeah. Oof.
We'll see.
Yeah. We'll see. But I think this is going to be one of those times where fans of the musical are going to be disappointed.
Yeah. Probably.
Probably. But that's in a couple weeks from now. Next week we got Jump Street and Dragon.
Yes.
So.
Very much looking forward to both of those.
Which is interesting. I think next week we should definitely talk about sequels in terms of...
For sure.
You know, for them it's like, sequels, but, you know...
These are two sequels that are super excited, like, super promising.
That's the... Agreed. So, cool. Well, do you have anything else you want to talk about with Edge of Tomorrow or Fault in Our Charge or Time for Rex?
I think it's Time for Rex. If you didn't see Edge of Tomorrow, go see it. I know a lot of people didn't. You might have thought it looked dumb or something, but it's well worth your time, especially seeing it in a theater. Don't wait for Netflix or Blu-ray.
Yeah, no, it's a good theater film. See it with a good sound system. You'll appreciate it. And you don't need to see it in 3D, obviously.
No.
But just want to make sure.
It goes without saying.
It goes without saying. Look, here's the rule. If it needs to be seen in 3D, we'll tell you.
Yeah.
We'll let you know. All right, Adam, what do you got for us this week?
In keeping with the theme of Fault in Our Stars, kind of a teen-geared movie, I'm going to recommend another excellent teen movie that is also an adaptation. It came out recently. It's The Perks of Being a Wallflower. This movie came out in 2012. It was unique in that Stephen Chbosky, who wrote the 1999 novel, also wrote and directed the film adaptation, which could have been a terrible disaster, especially given that the source material is basically, and like Fault in Our Stars, it's something when you describe it, it sounds terrible, but it's not because it's great. Is about a young teenager who's beginning his freshman year of high school. He's a little emotionally upset, not kind of altogether, and strikes up a friendship with two seniors, Sam, played by Emma Watson, and her stepbrother Patrick, played by Ezra Miller, in a fantastic performance, and I have been missing him lately. I want to see him in more stuff. And it's about teenagers, it's about kind of life in high school, but it's without any of the bullshit and any of the, you know, cliches. Like Fault in Our Stars, it treats all of this stuff kind of realistically. It's less twee than Fault in Our Stars. I think it's probably a better movie, probably better source material. Chbosky, who wrote and directed it, was not precious with his material at all. Made some changes, interesting changes that feel like made the movie better. Emma Watson gives a great performance. It's a movie that, and this is what I thought Fault in Our Stars would do, it came out in 2012, got positive critical response, almost critical raves, I would say. Ended up on a few top 10 lists. A lot of people thought it should have been nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars, but didn't make huge box office, didn't make much of a splash with the public, but it's a good film. It's also an important film. It's a film I think that teenagers should see, because I think it kind of speaks to a lot of issues that teenagers have growing up and kind of, you know, navigating the social whatever, what have you. So if you missed it, I highly, highly suggest you seeing Perks of Being a Wallflower. If you liked Fault in Our Stars, I recommend it even more. Owen Logan Lerman is the lead, and he is great in it. Another surprising part of it. because kind of like with Fault in Our Stars, I wasn't really sure how Ansel Elgort would do, but I thought he did a really good job. Logan Lerman is also excellent in Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Yes, trust your young actors, except when they're terrible.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I agree. Perks is great. My recommendation this week is, in case you haven't heard, Peyton Reed is your new Ant-Man director. Peyton Reed is actually not a bad director.
Nope.
He directed Bring It On, and which is a good film. And then I like his 2003 film, Down With Love, even better. So that's my recommendation. Down With Love is kind of a parody of the old Doris Day, Rock Hudson romance films, which are heavy in innuendo, but they're also very cute, and it's sort of this battle of the sexes. In Down With Love, Ewan McGregor plays this sort of cad for a, I believe it's a magazine company, and he's sort of jet-setting around the world, and then Renee Zellweger plays this author who writes a book called Down With Love, where she promotes the idea of having basically sexual liberation. And in one of the film, I mean, the film is filled with so many funny scenes, but when she pitches it to a boardroom of old white men, they're like, how can you have sex without love? And like, it's just like this pause moment. But it is, you know, and so, you know, she forwards this idea, which is sort of antithetical to Ewan McGregor's character, who basically peddles an idea of love, but he's sort of against the sexual equality notion. But at the same time, so you have these sort of warring ideals, and it sort of course, then becomes sort of a romance where he believes, in order to sort of take her down, that he has to make her fall in love with him, which leads to just some ridiculous moments. It's got a lot of style to it. I think that some people, they saw Peyton Reed's name, it's like, oh, you directed Yes Men, that doesn't have any style. But Down With Love does. I think if you want to have hope for Ant-Man, and let's face it, this is a sort of how much hope can you really have, I would just say, see Down With Love and be like, okay, this isn't horrible. Peyton Reed is a good director. Fun note, back before Tim Story got Fantastic Four, the idea was Peyton Reed was circling the project. And at the time, I was like, oh, that would have been fantastic. Sorry, no pun intended. And I would have liked to sort of see what he did with the material. So it's sort of funny that about 10 years later, he is now getting a superhero film. Not his own, under very less than ideal circumstances. But putting all that aside, I'm just happy for the opportunity to recommend Down With Love. So thanks for joining us, everyone. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
@AdamChitwood.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.